Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. The Star Wars universe has been expanding rapidly in recent years, from 2015's The Force Awakens, which continued the original series through Episode 7, to 2016's Rogue One, a standalone prequel. But most fans of the series reserve their fondest memories for the original trilogy, and my guest is still fighting the Battle of Endor. Charlie Ross brings his one-man Star Wars trilogy back to Proctor's in Schenectady on Saturday. It's a tour de force, so to speak, in a black box setting, with Ross performing everything from Chewbacca to John Williams' score. Charlie Ross, welcome back to the Roundtable.
How's it going?
It's been a while since you've been in town with the show, and as I mentioned, the universe has been changing in Star Wars. Has that had any effect on the show?
I think it's had some effect on the popularity of Star Wars, but as far as my show is concerned, other than informing the odd new joke, it, for the most part, still is the same, because, of course, it's based on the original Star Wars trilogy. And, I mean, that's sort of true when the prequels came out. That's around the time that my show first started. And I guess, in a way, I was sort of writing the popularity that was happening, not intending to, but that was sort of I was a byproduct. And I think that the new films, as much as it's reinvigorated the franchise, it's also cast people's attentions back to the, let's call it the higher kind of camp quality of the original trilogy.
Well, the reason I asked that question is you, I remember, had a kind of a tossed-off joke about the vulnerability in the Death Star, and with spoiler alert to our listeners now, Rogue One adds some canon to the reason why that's there. So that's why I was wondering if maybe it altered some of the show that you do.
Well, actually, believe it or not, I'm going to see Rogue One in about 2 hours.
Oh, so. Get out of here!
Yeah, I've actually never seen it, so that's all right. But that's just because I've got a 2.5-year-old daughter. It's been almost impossible to come see it. You know, you can't make any of these new films without it having to sort of center around the origin of something. And I figured that if they were looking to sort of make a story, it would have to be based around something that seemed glaringly stupid, you know, in maybe the original trilogy. So, no, I don't mean stupid, but just sort of somewhat more implausible than the very existence of a planet-sized space station that can blow up other planets. So it'll be interesting. I'll be sure not to tell my wife this awesome little spoiler. But, I mean, this is it. There's so many little tidbits, mistakes or whatever, that are in the past, as in, you know, we're in the original trilogy, that with Disney, it's like a toy box of broken toys in some ways that they can, almost like in Toy Story, they can take these old toys that we were used to and put them up on screen, and we all feel really clever because we, you know, we remember sort of what they were talking about. I guess that's sort of what my show in a very micro way is. I don't think any of my observations are beyond what the average person would probably observe, with the exception of maybe a couple of things. But that's what makes them jokes, is that they're familiar. We thought of it ourselves. Perhaps we haven't actually heard it articulated, at a certain point in the film. I'm almost like, if you remember Mystery Science Theater 3000, mm-hmm. I'm almost like the film and the peanut gallery at the same time.
Does your daughter like the movies, or is she too young?
She's too young. In fact, weirdly enough, about a week ago, I was over at my father-in-law's house. He had a brand new sound system that he put in for his television, like his little home theater. And we were just watching the first maybe 3 or 4 minutes of Star Wars, because, of course, you know, what better, you know, sort of better film to exhibit the quality of his sound system. And my daughter was sort of standing there, and the stormtroopers, they come into the blockade runner and immediately start killing each other, and she looked terrified. She ran away, of course,
because
it's a horrible noise. It's war, and I kind of thought, my goodness, I feel such childlike warmth for this, but I somehow the actual act of what I was seeing, I've become numb to what it is we're actually watching. So it was almost like a parental lesson at that moment to go, you know, if I'm going to introduce it to her, I think I'll introduce it, you know, in little bits and pieces, you know, until she can maybe understand even what life and death really is.
Are you surprised how mainstream it's become? You mentioned that the popularity has grown, so it's not such a nerdy world anymore.
I guess so, but that really becomes... That's sort of the long reach of Lucasfilm and then Disney. You know, Disney can take something like the Little Mermaid story and change it into something that's hugely popular and, you know, popularize it with music and, you know, these sort of the storyline, the themes, you know, maybe loosely based on the original material, but can... you know, sort of appeal to a much broader audience, you know, catchy songs. Whereas the original Little Mermaid story is quite sad at the end. You know, she turns into sea foam. She disappears. I don't think children would really stand for that. So I think because of Disney coming along and taking up the mantle of Star Wars, it's going to be popular because of their long reach. But I mean, ultimately, I don't think it'll kill the nerdyism that was there in its original form. If you look at the demographics of my audience, you can see the nerdiest of the nerds to the people that would be, you know, they kind of follow more popular trends, and they're both valid. It's just that you kind of have the old guard and you have the newbies, the people that are just sort of there and enjoying the fact that it's new and fun and everybody's going to see it. So, I don't cry for the nerds. You know, nobody cries for the nerds because I mean, I've been one and no one's ever cried for me.
That's the problem.
But we're happy to be who we are. I mean, we wouldn't have it any other way. And you can't fabricate a nerd. You know, there's that TV show, the Big Bang Theory, and any actual nerd can, you know, see beyond the cast and then see the writers, and, you know, then you can imagine that the writers, you know, the creators are the nerds that are behind the faces. So, you know, somehow behind the Wizard of Oz, there's still something that's authentic behind it. But, you can't really fabricate a nerd. And I can, after 2 minutes of talking to a person after a show, know usually what depths of nerdyism this person might sort of live in.
So describe what you were like then as a kid when you say nerd.
Well, this is a difficult thing. You see, nerds, I don't believe, started off entirely as nerds, and say of the Star Wars ilk, because it was once just hugely popular. Everybody, you know, was riding that wave. Everybody loved it. It's just, I don't know, a couple of years after the fact when things were kind of getting over. Maybe people were getting onto something new. And then you flash forward even further years later when Star Trek sort of had its resurgence. There was still the old guard of Star Wars that were there. People that, I guess, maybe they felt disenfranchised somewhat, you know, like Luke, like some of the other sort of rebels that were in that story, or the pirates. You know, like any story, I think it helps to sort of inform your life today. And... well, you know, whether you felt disenfranchised, as I was, living on a farm, so that's why I think I really related to Luke. And when I eventually moved to a larger town where I was around people more often, I still kind of felt this sort of Luke quality, which is that, you know, when Luke sort of gets immersed into the rebellion, he has a special place. But even then, eventually, because of what his past, who he is, he still eventually becomes even further marginalized until he's just sort of still separate, like a Frodo Baggins would be, you know, returns back home, and he's never really returning home. I mean, what a real nerd is a person that never totally feels comfortable around people. And I don't know why that is. You know, you find people that sort of band together. They have a very similar quality to their personality, and, you know, something like Star Wars opens these doors where you have costuming clubs, you know, and people get together and they they share their love of Star Wars, but even just their love of making models. It's weird that, you know, I guess what creates the Star Wars nerd or what creates the nerd is eventually what binds people together in a very profound way, if they find each other. And given today's sort of modern world, it's much easier to not feel quite so alone, you know, sort of finding that your similar loves are what really bring you together.
The last time we talked a few years ago, you told us about how one of the big breaks for your show was when you filled in for a canceled Carrie Fisher 2-week run of her one-woman show. What's your reaction to her death?
Well, it was odd. I was coming back from Tampa Bay to Canada, and I had just finished my book, so I was in the bookstore in Tampa Bay, and sure enough, there was her new The Princess Diarist that was just there, and I thought, oh, cool. I've read Wishful Drinking, I've read Postcards from the Edge, some other stuff that she's written as well, and I just thought, well, why not grab it? And I was surprised at how dishy it was, how full of scoop. It almost seemed like a piece of, you know, gossip from 40 years ago. And yet it was so heartfelt and so wonderfully put together, sort of her modern day wit with her younger self, you know, sort of over top of it in her old diaries. It was wonderful to read, and I thought, wow, what a wonderful inside look to something that seems a little bit just sort of deeper than humor into maybe what her heart really is. And then to know 2 days later that she had the heart attack and then died essentially 2 days later, and her mom died too. It was something. You know, playing her in the film, you know, as I do on stage, I mean, it's still, you know, what it is. It's just me sort of doing a kind of an impression of her. But to have this door, this book that sort of opens this door to something of who she is, it seemed sadder than I think it had any right to be in my life. And anybody who was a big Star Wars fan, I'm sure that, you know, all the guys had a crush on her when they first saw Star Wars, and she certainly was one of my first crushes. So it was, yeah, just something that felt profound, and yet I knew had nothing to do with me, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Has the purchase of Lucasfilm by Disney changed your professional life at all?
I don't know if it's actually changed my professional life. And in some ways, there's just sort of been a bit of a hands-off approach. You know, I'm not a broken thing, so there's no need to sort of fix me. And I really appreciate that. You know, Disney's been cool to me in the past, and they're definitely showing, I guess, their coolness in a way that I wasn't sure what was going to happen when the purchase first happened.
Well, I'm so glad you're still doing the show. You've been doing it for 16 years, and
yeah.
Charlie Ross will be back at Proctor's on Saturday for 2 shows of the one-man Star Wars trilogy. I've seen it a couple times, and I can't wait to see it again, so thank you so much for coming back.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, and Schenectady is totally awesome. This is actually the 3rd or 4th time I've come back, so I'm looking so forward to it.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.